Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're at the 22nd meeting of the Human Rights Committee, and today we're looking at Bill S-219, an act respecting a national day of commemoration of the exodus of Vietnamese refugees and their acceptance in Canada after the fall of Saigon and the end of the Vietnam War. I'm Deputy Chair of Human Rights, Senator Salma Taulajan. Senator Jaffer couldn't be here today. I would like the senators to introduce themselves, starting with the left.
Good morning, and thank you very much for coming. I'm Nikki from Ontario.
Senator Nancy Ruth from Toronto.
Scott Panis from Alberta.
Senator Ngo from Ontario.
Jim Cowan from Nova Scotia.
So, honorable senators, I would like to acknowledge that the Vietnamese ambassador has submitted additional materials for the committee's consideration subsequent to his letter to the chair, which you already have received. His submission will be filed by the committee and will be distributed as soon as it is translated. This morning, we have two witnesses. From the Canadian Immigration Historical Society, we have Mr. Mike Molly, who is the president. And from the Vietnamese Canadian Federation, Dr. Can Lee, who's the former president. So I understand, Mr. Molly, you were going to speak first.
Yes. Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Senators. I'm very honored to have been asked to speak today to you about Bill S-219 and the proposal to designate April 30th as a day to remember the exodus of Indo-Chinese refugees and the remarkable circumstances that attended their resettlement in Canada. I had the privilege of meeting Senator Than Hai Ngo a year ago at York University, where over 100 people gathered, including former refugees, former sponsors, officials, political leaders, and others, gathered for 3 days of remembrance and reflection on the Indo-Chinese movement and the launch of Canada's private refugee sponsorship program. So I was delighted to hear from the senator about this bill. My interest in this matter is threefold. First of all, as a rather young officer in the 70s, I was heavily involved in implementing the refugee provisions of the 1976 Immigration Act, which was the first act that had specific refugee provisions in it, and they included, among other things, the basis of Canada's famous private refugee sponsorship system, and a designated class making the selection of Indo-Chinese refugees much more simple than that of regular convention refugees. I was subsequently assigned to be senior coordinator in the summer of 1979 of a task force set up by the Deputy Minister of the Canadian Employment and Immigration Commission to manage the movement of 60,000 Indo-Chinese refugees to Canada in 1979 and 80. As senior coordinator, I guess the best way to describe me was I was the lowest man on the totem pole responsible for everything, from overseas selection to transportation to reception to matching with sponsors to sending the people to their final destinations and the settlement arrangements that were in place for them there. Second, within the Canadian Immigration Historical Society, we are in the final stages of writing the first comprehensive history of the Indo-Chinese refugee movement since 1983. We decided, since we were all getting old and since we hadn't told all of the war stories from that time, that it was good to capture them now, and we're hoping that the book will come out in this year. And it will focus on what it took to move those 60,000 people in a period of 18 months from one side of the world to the other. Third, coming out of the conference I mentioned earlier at York University, the Center for Refugee Studies at York, the Sponsorship Agreement Holders Association of Canada, and the Canadian Immigration Historical Society are involved with members of the Indo-Chinese community in a multi-year project to ensure that the history of a truly remarkable period in Canadian history is recorded and preserved. And I have a handout here that describes that project. To briefly trace what happened and why it was so remarkable. As Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam fell to the communist onslaught in the spring of 1975, a very large number of young Vietnamese from Montreal arrived on Parliament Hill terrified about what would be happening to their families back home. The government of the day, shocked to see so many people on the front lawn, I suppose, agreed that they could return home to Montreal. We would keep the immigration offices open for 24 hours a day, and whether they had status in Canada or not, they were allowed to sponsor their relatives in the hopes that we could get at them. In a matter of a few weeks, they submitted 10,000 sponsorships for 17,000 people, and these were all sent by telex. Remember what telex was? Sent by telex to Hong Kong. They came in such numbers that repeatedly the rolls on the telex machine were exhausted, and things had to be repeated. The immigration staff in Hong Kong attempted to extract people from Vietnam at that time. The government provided three Hercules aircraft, but in the dying days of the government of South Vietnam, they refused to issue people with exit permits. And all we were able to do, and it was not a small thing, was to extract about 90 babies that were brought to Canada for placement in Canadian homes. When Saigon actually fell, about 130,000 people got into boats of all sorts and headed out to sea, where they were rescued by the United States Navy. The Navy moved them first to Hong Kong, and then the monsoons came. So they moved them to Guam, and then the monsoons came, and then they moved them to military camps in the southern United States. In all of those places, a Canadian team based in Hong Kong moved in to try and rescue as many of the people as we could who had Canadian connections, and another 3,000 on top of that. In all, in the 4 or 5 months following the fall of Saigon, we moved 7,000 people to Canada. Over the next 2 years, there was a bit of a lull, and it's in that period of time that we brought into effect the 1976 Immigration Act, which included two things that were going to be really important in the subsequent years. One was the sponsorship program, and the second was the ability for the government to pass what was called a designated class, which greatly simplified the business of selecting refugees from Indochina. Over the winter of 78 and 79, the number of people heading out to sea in overcrowded small fishing boats to escape worsening conditions in Vietnam, where there was famine and various other natural disasters, and where the government had embarked on the ethnic cleaning of the Chinese minority, the numbers escalated to the point where they went from a few thousands a month to a few ten thousands a month to several ten thousands a month to 60,000 people taking to the boats in the month of June 1979. 60,000. The countries of the in the area, Malaysia, Thailand, Indonesia, Singapore, were so alarmed by this as these people came ashore that they closed the shores. Of the 60,000 people that came out that 1 month, probably another 40,000 died along the way. And as people were pushed off, the death rate went up. In reaction to this, the United Nations, not the United Nations High Commissioner, but the United Nations Secretary General got involved. And the very month that the government of Joe Clark assumed power in Canada, the Secretary General called for an emergency meeting in Geneva that was to take place in the middle of July 1979. In that time, the Canadian Mennonite Committee, which was the first community in Canada to sign an agreement on the sponsorship of refugees, held a series of consultations with the new foreign minister, Flora MacDonald, suggesting, perhaps even demanding, that Canada do something spectacular. And at the same time, initially, the Conservative government upped the quota from 5,000 to 8,000 and suggested that maybe another 4,000 could be brought in by sponsors. That's in June. In July, in response to the worsening situation and the fact we were going to have to make an announcement in Geneva, the cabinet met again. The new Canadian, the new immigration minister, Ron Atkey, brought into cabinet a copy of Irving Abella's book, None Is Too Many, the famous book about that infamous episode in Canadian history when we turned away an ocean liner full of Jews in the late 30s, most of whom perished in the subsequent Holocaust. Atkey read from that book when the cabinet meeting opened, and he turned to his colleagues and said, how do we want to be remembered? It was kind of a dramatic moment, I'm told. We met with Mr. Atkey some months ago, and it was the first time I'd heard that story. So when Flora MacDonald went to Geneva a few days later, she announced that Canada would be accepting 50,000 refugees. Now, when you compare that with the Hungarians, 37,000, the Czechs, 11,000, the Ugandans, 6,000, the Chileans, by that time, about 7,000. This was a staggering number. It certainly staggered those of us who were in the immigration department in the business of that at that time. We had no idea that they were going to bring such an enormous number in. Interesting sideline, the original plan was for 60,000, but you might recall the Clark government ran on the platform of reducing the civil service by 60,000, and so they thought the juxtaposition of 60,000 disappearing civil servants and 60,000 incoming refugees might not go down all that well in the press. The UN High Commission for Refugees was delighted by the number that Canada announced, but expressed alarm in writing, I've seen the correspondence, that so much of the Canadian commitment would depend on private citizens, because the announcement required that there be 21,000 privately sponsored people matched by 21,000 government-sponsored people. So, and UNHCR didn't think we'd be able to carry it through. Then the citizens of Canada did something that was quite amazing. In July, the month of the announcement, 359 groups came forward to sponsor 2,200 refugees. In August, 1,420 groups came forward to sponsor 8,000 refugees. And when the program closed in December 1980, 7,675 groups had sponsored just short of 40,000 refugees, twice as many as the government had asked for, which caused us, the people in the Department of Finance, to have a conniption. I must say it was really complicated. But that was quite something amazing, really quite amazing, an unusual moment in our history. In that 18-month period, small teams of very young Canadian visa officers, and we had to send the youngsters out there because the conditions were so difficult, anybody over 30 probably would have perished in the process, visa offices operating in Thailand and Malaysia, Indonesia, Philippines, Hong Kong, and Macau put 60,049 refugees on 181 charter flights that came to Canada, landing in Edmonton and Montreal. Of the 60,000, 1,700 were sponsored by relatives, 26,000 were sponsored by the government, and 33,000 were sponsored by private citizens. So the citizens of Canada took the biggest part of the burden. It was an amazing achievement. It was made possible by outstanding leadership at all levels of government, from mayors and aldermen right up to cabinet ministers, and both federal and provincials, by hardworking public servants. I'll tell you how hardworking it was. The book we are writing is called Running on Empty. And when I tell the veterans of the Vietnam movement, yes, we're calling it Running on Empty, they all go, yeah, that's right. But the real heroes of this were literally hundreds of thousands of Canadians who sponsored refugees through their churches and their synagogues, their service clubs, their unions, and ad hoc groups of friends and neighbors that got together to take advantage of this program. As you know, the UN was so impressed by the Canadian accomplishment that in 1986, the people of Canada were awarded the Nansen Medal, the refugee equivalent of the Nobel Prize. We are the first people, and we are the only people to have been so honored. We have probably settled over 500,000 refugees in this country since the Second World War. So why should we be thinking about singling out this group for special recognition? First, the Indo-Chinese movement ran from 1975 well into the 90s and was eventually supplemented by a really vigorous family reunification program from Vietnam. It was by far, and remains by far, the largest resettlement operation we've ever undertaken. It brought us close to 200,000 new citizens, and when all was said and done, the refugees and their dependents now account for over 300,000 of our fellow Canadians. Secondly, the astonishing reaction of hundreds of thousands of Canadians who took up the government's challenge and sponsored twice as many refugees as they were asked to sponsor in the first place is an outstanding example of our people living up to our best values. If approved by Parliament, this special day will affirm to our fellow Indo-Chinese citizens that we are proud that they are now part of our society, and it will provide an ongoing reminder of what we can do in this country when we follow our best instincts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wally. Dr. Candley.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Madam Deputy Chair, members of the Senate Human Rights Committee, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come here and express my view regarding Bill S-219 concerning the proposal for a national day of commemoration of the exodus of Vietnamese refugees, their acceptance in Canada after the fall of Saigon, and the end of the Vietnam War on April 30, 1975. I believe that a national day of commemoration in Canada on April 30th each year for the exodus of close to 1 million Vietnamese refugees after the end of the Vietnam War and for Canada's acceptance of more than 60,000 of these refugees will enshrine an important event in Canadian history and will enrich the cultural and social mosaic of this country. The Vietnamese Canadian Federation, of which I am one of the co-founders and a former Secretary General, is an umbrella organization founded in 1980 to represent Vietnamese community organizations from coast to coast. At present, the Federation includes organizations in the Vietnamese community in Halifax, Sherbrooke, Montreal, Ottawa, Toronto, Windsor, Winnipeg, Saskatoon, Edmonton, Calgary, and Vancouver. Its national office is located in Ottawa. Throughout its 34-year history, the Federation has helped thousands of Vietnamese refugees resettle in Canada. In addition to promoting cultural mutual understanding and advocating for democracy, freedom, and human rights in Vietnam, I would like to share with you my observations with regard to the background of the exodus of refugees from Vietnam in the late 70s and early 80s, which led me to support this bill. Following the invasion of South Vietnam by the North Vietnamese Communists in 1975, hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, members of the armed forces of the Republic of Vietnam, government officials or supporters, religious leaders, intellectuals, were put in hard labor concentration camps, officially called re-education camps, where thousands would eventually die due to execution, diseases, or malnutrition. Many others were exiled to the so-called new economic zones in remote regions of Vietnam. In addition, ethnic Chinese Vietnamese were forced to relocate or expelled from the country due to the political conflict between China and Vietnam in 1979. Under these circumstances, people rushed to flee the country by the thousands. There was a famous saying in Vietnam at that time, if lampposts can walk, they would flee too. The flow of refugees from Vietnam reached a critical phase in late 1978 due to a the refusal of some neighboring Asian countries to admit the boat people, who were so-called because most fled in small, leaky boats in the perilous Eastern Sea, formerly called South China Sea. Hundreds of thousands of these refugees perished at sea by drowning or starvation, or were raped or killed by pirates. Dennis McDermott, president of the Canadian Labour Congress at the time, summarized the situation as follows. It is crystal clear to us that the Vietnamese refugee problem has ballooned into a humanitarian crisis of global proportion, and the only human way to react to such a situation is through decisive and immediate action. In response to the plight of these refugees in 1979, Marion Duard of the City of Ottawa called a meeting of community organizations, church groups, and social service agencies in the city in her office to discuss the ways to help them. As a result, Project 4000 was formed with the objective of campaigning for the admission of up to 4,000 Indo-Chinese refugees, the majority of whom came from Vietnam to the city of Ottawa through the private sponsorship program of the federal government. Similar community initiatives followed elsewhere in Canada, most notably the Operation Lifeline, spearheaded by Professor Howard Edelman in Toronto. Little more than 2 weeks elapsed from the initial meeting of church leaders, ethnic community representatives, and immigration officials in Mayor Duard's office on June 27, 1979, until the rally at the Ottawa Civic Center on July 12. And yet, it was in this short period that the structure of one of the largest grassroots social movements in Canada history was formed. Within a month of that rally, which attracted close to 3,000 people, many more than originally expected, most of the 347 sponsor groups had been formed and registered at the local immigration office. Subsequently, the federal government under Prime Minister Jokla decided to accept 50,000 refugees, as Mike Molloy just mentioned, mostly Vietnamese, but also including Cambodians and Laotians who fled the newly established communist regime in their countries. Project 4000 was Ottawa's response to the boat people crisis of 1979. Canadians from across the country were quick to offer help, involving thousands of volunteers from all walks of life. I had the honor and the privilege to serve as a member of the board of directors of this project from 1979 to 1983. I learned a lot by working with hundreds of volunteers in the project. I also came to understand the plight of the refugees, those who left everything in Vietnam and risked their lives and the lives of their loved ones in search of freedom. In the words of two former volunteers of Project 4000, Eleanor Ryan and Sue Pack, Project 4000 was a huge risk for both refugees and sponsors. It required a leap of faith on both parties, but in the end, Ottawa emerged greatly enriched from the experience. I think that the same thing can be said of the work done by hundreds of sponsor groups set up elsewhere in Canada to help Vietnamese refugees rebuild their lives in freedom. The story of this outstanding project was well documented in the book entitled Gift of Freedom, which I have a copy here. You'd like to take a look afterward. Written by Brian Buckley and disseminated in 2008 by the Vietnamese Canadian Federation. Since their arrival in Canada, all of these refugees have, over the years, rapidly integrated themselves into the Canadian society and made important contributions to the prosperity of this country. As well, they helped in the preservation of its great values. There are thousands of Canadians of Vietnamese origin who are now were the children and grandchildren of the refugees who now work as professionals in various fields, such as medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, engineering, law, economics, education, information technology, accounting, and so on. Hundreds of Vietnamese businesses are blooming across the country. As well, the community has started to become involved in politics with representatives at both provincial and federal levels. By approving this bill, Parliament will assure newcomers and their future generations of their place in this country and will prove that Canada's inclusiveness is the foundation of its strength and prosperity. The resettlement of thousands of refugees in the aftermath of the Vietnam War is yet another shining chapter in the history of Canada. It's once again showed the compassion and generosity of the Canadian people in response to the sufferings of people around the world, including those who fled tyrannical regimes in search of freedom. This shining chapter should be honored and enshrined in Canadian history. This, I believe, is the main reason for Bill S-219. Madam Deputy Chair, members of the committee, ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now we'll turn to the Senator's question. Senator Nancy Root, to be followed by Senator Tanis.
Thank you very much for your presentations. We have a letter from the ambassador of the Socialist Republic of Vietnam in front of us. And in it, he says that he believes strongly that this bill does not represent the views of the majority of Vietnamese Canadians. How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't know where he got the information from. But we in the Vietnamese Canadian Federation are not aware of any opposition to this bill, except perhaps from the embassy. All the information that we have received so far is that it's overwhelmingly supported by members of the Vietnamese community in Canada.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Tanis.
Thank you, Chair. And gentlemen, thank you for your presentations today. I enjoyed your story. It was excellent. Thank you very much for that history. Doctor, I understand that we actually accepted a couple of dozen refugees from Vietnam just this weekend here in Canada.
28.
So this story is not finished. What do you think that those 28 that arrived this weekend would think about this bill, and on reflection, would they be supportive of it?
Thank you very much, Senator, for your question. I just want to add a couple of pieces of information to your question. These 28 refugees who arrived in Canada last week were from Thailand. They were stranded in Thailand for over 20 years.
Yes.
And the Vietnamese Canadian Federation, together with an organization in the United States,